de un apartamental pulga infestado vienen los livings de un hombre encantador. ¡It's Batsegando!
Thank you, Jorge. Thank you very much indeed for usurping the few brain cells I had left from last night's bachelor party. Kids, this is Bat Segundo, and I tried very hard to get somewhere with last night's main attraction. I'm not exactly proud of this, but you see, despite the fact that I offered her a Benjamin Franklin, she said she needed a few hundred dollars more, quite a lot more, to the tune of a four-digit sum. Well, I may be a former DJ in disgrace, but I'm man enough to confess that I'm a lonely man. It's been 2 years. That's a lot of chickens choked, if you understand what my vernacular is. And when she wasn't smitten with me, I went home and sobbed like a sour baby. I assure you that what I felt for this daring young lady was unrequited love. Genuine love based upon this young lady's ambition, and of course her enormous breasts. I'll confess this was not the most noble emotional reaction to have, given the circumstances, but then I'm quite an easy young lad, or rather a middle-aged one. Well, it's only fitting that our young roving correspondent talked with Norman Sullivan, who seems to specialize in something else that's quite easy, namely war. In other words, something quite alternative from my emotions, something I quite can't actually understand, but then enough about me. Mr. Solomon is a man that's been around for quite some time. His column, Media Beat, examines current media biases. It's a nationally syndicated column that, with its truths and frightening examples, I guarantee will scare the living bejesus out of you, and then some. As if this weren't enough, Mr. Solomon has a new book entitled War Made Easy. While this may seem like a self-help manual, and I certainly confused it as such for someone like Mr. Rumsfeld, well, it really isn't. The chapters are laid out as headings, and Mr. Solomon cites several disturbing examples proving his point concerning how the U.S. government specializes in a spectacular deceit, and then some.
We just got back from a book signing that you, or book reading that you did at Modern Times Bookstore. I wanted to start by telling, by pointing out a New Yorker Talk of the Town item by George Packer this week. And he wrote about how the phrase, the war on terror, has been replaced by global struggle against violent extremism. And the interesting thing is that Packer wrote, the administration is right to reconsider its strategy starting from the language. Will anything else follow? Now, perhaps it's a pessimist in me after reading your book, but I wanted to ask you, does such a question even need to be asked today? Or is the relationship between government, media, and language hopelessly corrupt?
Well, one doesn't want to be so pessimistic as to foreclose in one's expectation any possibility of positive change. But I am very skeptical that there's anything more than a kind of a cosmetic makeover being contemplated or implemented. Mm-hmm. I think that quite often it's that question, and as you know, there's a chapter in my book about what the U.S. government needs is better PR. And that's been pretty thematic and probably, so to speak, a thematically held view that, gee, they don't love us around the world. Well, they must not understand us. And I do use the analogy, as I did tonight, I think, in the bookstore talk, that it's as though a company was manufacturing candy bars, and the candy bars contained poison, and people reacted rather negatively to the product. And so the manufacturer said, well, obviously, we need a better wrapper and a better advertising campaign. This is, I think, you know, roughly analogous, at least from the perspective of a lot of people in the Arab world, the Muslim world, and for that matter, a lot of just poor countries or even French people.
Well, there was also the infamous remark, better products come out in August is not the time to unveil new products.
Exactly. That, you know, Andrew Card, the chief of staff of the White House in 2002, you know, late summer, just not the time. So, and indeed, they did float some trial balloons, but it was September when the sales job for the invasion began in earnest. I mean, I think that it has become a cliche, but it's an apt cliche that wars are being sold like other sorts of products. I can remember back in 19, 69 or so, Joe McGinnis's book came out, The Selling of the President, 1968. Mm-hmm. And people will remember perhaps the at least the initial cover of that book had a pack of cigarettes on it, and mm-hmm. then the picture of Richard Nixon was on the cover of the pack of cigarettes.
I wish I could have seen this cover. I know the book. But
yeah, and it was at that point a almost a scandalous visual imagery, because just people weren't accustomed to thinking of politics in such a crass terms. What I now refer to as the intersection between Madison Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue, we're almost inured to it now. We just take it for granted that that's the way it rolls. And I just found it very telling and fascinating. When Charlotte Beers was brought in as a crackerjack, a lowercase crackerjack, advertising whiz after 9/11, Colin Powell brought her into the State Department, and she said, "This is the most challenging brand assignment I've ever had, which is to brand the United States with a more affirmative and positive connotation around the planet." I don't think it was a very effective sales job in retrospect.
Yeah, and she actually left, too.
She did leave. I mean, of course, to her defense, how do you sell something that is dropping bombs on people? You know, Medea Benjamin tells this story, which I think is kind of apropos, of going to Afghanistan after the bombing began. And there was a woman out in the very rural area, and there had been some bombing where people were killed as a result of the U.S. Dropping bombs. And there was a woman who was asked by the visiting Americans, what do you think about Osama bin Laden and the conflict with the United States? And Medea tells us that this woman replied, who is Osama bin Laden and what is the United States? Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Clearly for people who have bombs falling on them, maybe what's uppermost in their minds is not what's uppermost in the minds of the punditocracy in Washington.
Well, I wanted to go back to this concept of the war as a product. We experienced, for example, conflicts and wars in the 80s and 90s where we had sort of this quick war without American casualties approach. And we sort of have a different contrast with the current conflict in Iraq, when that it's long and that there is casualties even though we don't actually see them. And I'm wondering, is there any sort of indication that this will change some of the mentalities that form the titles in your chapters, or do we have any kind of indication that definitions are being solidified or changed? What would you say to that?
Well, I think there's a flexibility, and you know, one of the capacities that's very striking is that in the merchandising of war, so to speak, there has to be flexibility, which is almost an Orwellian characteristic in and of itself. You have to be able to say that black is black, and then later on find a way to say that black is white. And I don't think it's really an exaggeration. You could use the analogy that, you know, the product has to keep moving off the shelves. And if it isn't moving and there's some consumer resistance, then you find other images, phrases, just the reinvention of products in and of itself is sometimes necessary. It gets stale, it gets old.
So we could liken the Iraq conflict right now. I use the term conflict, strangely enough, because I don't even know if it's a war. But we can use that as sort of like that's the new Coke compared to the old Coke of, like, you know, fast, no American casualties, we'll ignore the civilian casualties, and now we ignore even the American casualties.
I think there has to be some continuity, and there is inevitably got to be some new twists on it, you know. For instance, is there one villain, you know, Saddam Hussein, or Afghanistan didn't quite have that. There was Mullah Omar or something, but you know, so these there is the flexibility there.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you about the notion of war that you present in your book. Do you think this is specifically American, or is this patterns that are repeating through history?
Well, definitely war propaganda has been going on for thousands of years, and as well the need to make the enemy, quote-unquote, seem inhuman, unhuman, bloodless. The 180 from the virtuous people on our side who are fighting or being defended or both. So that the net result is that you have these kind of archetypes, but within that context, there are really peculiar American, like the first buzz phrase or concept, really, the assumption concept that I made the title of chapter number one is America's a fair, noble superpower. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of countries where you go and they're not using the flag in such a way. I was talking to a British friend of mine the other day who was saying, you know, we just don't wave the Union Jack in that way.
Yeah.
And the notion that we're number one would be rather ludicrous to people who live in Belgium, so they don't even try, you know.
But in a different sense with Britain, you have the common sense line that was handed out by Tony Blair recently.
Yes, that we are British. We have this unique, or this at least this admirable capacity that's cultural and proclivity to, we have common sense, indeed. And so, you know, the implication is, I'm the personification of that common sense. Trust me, that was kind of a subtext. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'll tell you who to deport.
Well, I wanted to sort of focus in on the time period you started with. You dealt with a period of 40 years, starting with the Dominican Republic in 1975, the invasion by Lyndon Baines Johnson.
65,
yes. And I wanted to find out why you settled in on 40 years, this particular figure.
Well, I was looking for kind of a modern wave of intervention, and I was somewhat surprised to read, and at first I wasn't sure it was true, but it is, that the invasion of the Dominican Republic was the first U.S. invasion in the hemisphere in several decades.
Yes.
And it seemed to embody, like, in retrospect, a number of invasions. It was the you could argue, the first, along with the Vietnam War, which is kind of concurrently being implemented, the first TV war, mm-hmm. you know, where that was a really significant
factor. The first internet war, even.
The Dominican.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so the Dominican, but, yeah. You know, that came along later, you know, of course, later on, maybe the Gulf War was, you know, in a minute.
Yeah, well, there's, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and so you had that happening, and you go back to the 50s, and it was just, a lot of it was Cold War bluster and different sorts of CIA intervention, mm-hmm. but the boots on the ground, as the saying goes, it was a modern, in retrospect, especially the implementation of a sort of a modern era. I think also there was an element that was the first intervention that I remember as a young person. I would have been like 14, and at the time seemed like a really good thing to me. And so I found that there was a certain sort of benefit that I had. I could remember all these interventions. I'm not saying I was a meticulous newspaper reader at age 13 or anything, but it's helpful to kind of remember the mood of the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So are you suggesting then that the headers of your chapters, these attitudes, these specific statements have only formed recently in the last 40 years, or have they always been around in some sense? I mean,
I think they've been shaped. For instance, we might walk through them, but the United States wasn't a superpower 60 or 70 years ago. It was a major power. But you wouldn't say, you know, going into World War I, the United States was the world's superpower, or even one of the world's two superpowers. There was one of, you know, it was not a unipolar world. And I think in the sweep of the last 40 years, the world has gone from bipolar, you know, U.S.-Soviet, to unipolar. And this is, in a way, kind of the history there. And there is something to, as I say, television, modern communications, that sort of thing. But I think they are archetypes that go back hundreds of years. If we walk through the list, it would be interesting. Human rights, I think, has been more emphasized. Mm-hmm. You know, McKinley, a century ago, didn't particularly say, I think, you know, we're there to uphold human rights. You know, we're going to Christianize them or whatever, and Manifest Destiny and
so on.
Yeah,
I was
going to
bring up Manifest Destiny or even the Spanish-American War.
Yeah,
I mean,
you bet.
These were things that, you know, seemed to me to be America as empire. I mean, perhaps the foreign global nature of this hadn't been established yet, because we were just in the process of developing the West and trying to get that sort of streamlined.
There's certainly more pretensions to being altruistic now. Mm-hmm. And I think my chapter headings kind of reflect that, you know, this is about human rights, going out of our way to say, well, of course we seek no gain, you mm-hmm. know. And when I quote Charles Krauthammer, he's an example, you know, we seek no tribute, you know. And this is, you know, there's kind of maybe a tacit recognition that, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and McKinley weren't exactly in it for humanity.
Yeah. Well, Theodore Roosevelt wrote A History of Naval Warfare. There you go. Now, a war hawk might read your book and might say, well, can one actually criticize the actions of the government and the media structure without being privy to all the national security documents? How would you answer that person?
Well, I would quote, as I did in the book, Daniel Ellsberg, who was privy to very top secret documents, including but not only what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. And that, in fact, and I may have, maybe should have mentioned it more in the in the book. I do refer to it, which was very big during the Vietnam War, and we haven't heard so much more recently, that the president knows things we don't know. Mm-hmm. And we need to, and this is often implicit, we got to trust them. They're the ones with the information. And of course, that's a way of simply saying that we don't have a responsibility. You know, Daniel Ellsberg says that a lot of things are kept secret forever, but knowing secrets is not the same as knowing things that will change our minds about the morality of a war. In fact, secrecy doesn't really enable those folks to know more. It means that they're more manipulative. And I think a key point, too, is that ultimately there are not authorities of moral judgment. If you go back to McNamara or Acheson or the Dulles brothers, yeah, they knew a lot of information the public didn't know, but did that mean they were more expert in moral issues? I think the answer is pretty clearly no.
Okay. You actually have a very interesting report in terms of the Vietnam War and whether upfront coverage is actually, you know, going to cause anti-war sentiment. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate upon this, and I want to sort of ask a follow-up, but I first of all wanted to sort of hear what you had to say about this.
Well, I drew very heavily on the great work of Daniel Hallin, who's been a professor of communications at the University of California at San Diego for a long time and wrote the book about 20 years ago, I think, called The Uncensored War. And he went back and looked at the footage of the actual TV broadcasts and transcripts and print outlets and so forth. And, you know, there's a lot of mythology about how aggressive and tough and independent the U.S. media coverage of the Vietnam War was. And I think it's not really supported by the facts. I remember, because I was paying attention, so I have this kind of bifocal look. I look at somebody who is systematic and I think empirical, like Dan Hallin as an academic researcher. But also I remember, and this does track this way, there was tremendous vilification of anti-war protesters year after year, 65 through the decade and into the 70s. That shifted as it became, if not a majoritarian movement, the anti-war movement became deeper involved in communities at the grassroots and more, of course, widely supported. And also there was a lot of de facto trust in Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon reflected in the news media.
But I'm referring specifically to the 1973 investigation by Edward J. Epstein.
Yes.
That's what I was specifically referring to. That you referenced in the book demonstrated that when exposed to the carnage in Vietnam, people weren't likely to necessarily have anti-war, develop anti-war sentiments.
Yeah.
And I guess my question here is, you know, since these investigations were 30 years ago, do you think that these still apply? I was wondering why that there wasn't an additional sort of study that you relied upon to point this particular thing out. I mean, for example, September 11th, we were exposed to the plane crashing into the World Trade Center, but we weren't actually, we didn't see the bodies that jumped out of the windows because they didn't want to get burned to death.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that Epstein's study still applies? And do you have a more recent sort of finding that you can sort of, you know, proffer?
Well, I think it kind of tracks with what Daniel Hallin said. And in fact, and I mentioned this in the book, Daniel Hallin cites other scholars at the time and says that there was really no contrary findings to the extent you can empirically measure such things, there was no dispute among the specialists that the coverage was not a kind of a motor pulling an anti-war movement or anti-war sentiment along through the public. If anything, the media tended to lag behind. I think it's very difficult to establish clear causality of, you know, people are moved to become anti-war because or not because of what's on TV. But I think as you're referring to, the stuff that Epstein did that was published in TV Guide does kind of track parallel to what Hallin found and other researchers found. And no, I don't really think that there's any reason to think that that was some anomaly. I mean, that was a hell of a laboratory, the Vietnam War. And it went on for so many years. It's been the longest and most deadly war on both sides for so many decades. So I think it was a good laboratory.
There. However, in 1973, there was no CNN. There was no martial music that scared the bejesus out of you. There was no scrolling sort of ticker tape back then. Uh-huh. So given that the fact that media itself has changed, I'm wondering, you know...
Well, you know, there's a lot of fair studies around the media bias. I mean, there's no question, and I cite some of them in the book, that media bias is pro-war.
Yeah.
You know, when we look at the stats, very, very pro-war. So how would we measure how critical coverage of the war affects people? There's so little. And then where's the causality? I mean, some people listen to Democracy Now. Are they anti-war because they listen to Democracy Now? Or are they listening to Democracy Now because they're already in that direction? Which I think there are a lot of loops that are going on that are self-reinforcing. We do talk about some of the studies that public opinion project at the University of Maryland has measured, where the people who are most pro-war are the most ignorant. That's kind of a blunt way to say it. But this was done empirically. The people who believed things that were untruths about, you know, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, there were ties with Al-Qaeda and the Saddam Hussein regime, they tended to be more pro-war. They also tended to be more likely to watch Fox News channels. So there does seem a correlation between ignorance about empirical fact and eagerness to support a war.
Okay. Well, I'll get back to that soon, but I wanted to sort of talk about online media and traditional media and how we're starting to sort of see a interesting evolution with online media and a sort of chasm between the two. Blogs, for example, were instrumental in the whole Dan Rather scandal. And of course, even before that, in 2002, and something that's not necessarily brought up all the time, there was Trent Lott's infamous, you know, support of Strom Thurmond's 1948 segregational campaign. Mm-hmm. Richard Parson, in the July 31st, 2005 New York Times book review, said that the blogosphere is essentially not 12 million separate enterprises, but one enterprise with 12 million reporters. Now, if that's the case, if we accept the blogosphere like that, is there a common ideology that's being reflected in the media? Do these blogs represent a new hope, or are they going to have more of the same, do you think? Or are they doomed to, you know, fall into the same patterns?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, my sense of things is that there's a lot of diversity among people who are called bloggers, and that they tend to cluster, maybe, in terms of how they link and exchange information, that maybe through culture or general political outlooks. And, you know, the examples you gave, I think, are very telling. We could look at the Downing Street memo as well.
Yes.
Bloggers helped to bring that out.
Yes.
Well, those who went after, were so eager to go after Dan Rather, probably generally, with some exceptions, had a different ideological set of priorities than what we're talking about Downing Street memo. And I think that's to the good. I mean, it's important for information to be probed, you know. And when I was growing up in the 60s and even into the 70s, there were three networks when it came to non-print media, and they were the gods, you know. And the reporting in retrospect was, you know, often not very, very good journalism. So I think there is a very interesting absence of the GIGO principle even being discussed. When I was first aware of computers, I heard that phrase, garbage in, garbage out. I don't hear that now. Which it seems to me, maybe people kind of understand that just because you have really high production values on your website and have a really good set of links and you're heavily visited, that it doesn't mean you're really doing quality journalism. But there's a little bit of razzle-dazzle fascination with the technology coming from mainstream media that I don't trust. You can hear it on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. You see it in the New York Times all the time, as though because it is a blog, or it's this or that, you know, and God help us, soon it will be as a podcast, so therefore it lessens. So there are assumptions made. I mean, I just saw just ugly crap on the Drudge Report. You know, admittedly, he's not got the greatest sophisticated design on his screen, but, you know, I suppose he's a blogger of sorts, right? And maybe one of the
one of the initiators, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
And, you know, people forget that at important moments he was taken under the wing of huge corporations. I remember it was MSNBC,
yeah.
I may be calling wrongly,
yeah.
But it was one of those huge, if you will, traditional, pre-digital media institutions that hyped this guy and helped give him visibility. I saw him just
But Cosmo was being hyped back then. So was Pets.com.
Yeah.
They were willing to leap on almost anything.
Oh, sure.
That's the other factor, too.
Yeah. I mean, there weren't a lot of, frankly, left-wing blogs that were promoted like Drudge through the corporate media. The stuff I saw, like Cindy Sheehan just being smeared by Drudge just in the last couple of days. And, you know, it's just, well, he's a hatchet guy. Now, some people on the right may feel that the left has hatchet guy bloggers, but ultimately the factuality ought to be how we measure it.
Well, I wanted to say, I mean, do you agree with the sentiment that it may be one enterprise with 12 billion reporters, or are these individual voices, and is this a good thing or a bad thing, or is it too early to tell?
I mean, I think it may be displaced. It's a little bit pretentious if somebody's describing these as 12 million reporters. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what is the quality of the work? I'm sure it runs the gamut, you know? I mean, to me, it's like people who use print media. They run the gamut, too. And I think there's a fascination with technology which is part of historical continuity. You know, you go back to the late 1700s, and the most crude telegraphs were first being used. And the mythos was that the technology itself was going to be a force, maybe the force, for democracy. And then you go through the 20th century, radio was going to do it, broadcast TV was going to do it, cable television was going to do it, then email and the internet and websites, and now, of course, there's these latest. And I think it's understandable, and there's certainly some positive qualities of all of these things, including what Gutenberg did. But there's no guarantee, and I think there's just, you know, too much hype.
Well, I'll go back to traditional media here. I wanted to ask you, how do you think media can cover something properly if, number one, they face potential retaliation? You have an example in your book of Ray Bonner at El Mazote. There's also Elizabeth Becker in the 70s trying to cover Khmer Rouge and not being able to really get the full sort of extent of coverage in all the work that she was doing with the Washington Post and the New York Times. So if they face retaliation or resistance for doing hard-nosed reporting, how can they do their job? Number two, already we're starting to see with newspapers and magazines a drop-off in subscription. So given that, given the editors are trying to scramble and trying to retain their readers, how can traditional media hope to do the job of journalism that you would like them to see and that you describe in your book?
Yeah, I think there's so much variety, you know, because we could pick up all the daily papers in the United States tomorrow and we would see some really good journalism being done by people who in some cases had to do it against some formidable obstacles, maybe interpersonal in the newsroom, maybe their editors leaned on them not to do it, and so on and so forth. But I do like to say, because I think it's true, that the essence of propaganda is repetition, and so there's kind of the individually created or at least observed crack in the walls of the media structures. But there is the structure that has an overall kind of confining and retaining effect, both on the journalistic workforce writ large, but on the society as a whole. And so, you know, of course, out of necessity here, we're generalizing. But as we see, and this kind of to me flows into your second question, which I think is also important, we see this very intense scramble from the management end of things to tweak and change things so that the drop-off in, say, print newspaper daily circulation can be at least slowed, if not stopped or reversed. And one classic example is what's happened to the Times Mirror Corporation in the last 10 years, where you had, first of all, this guy brought in, I think his name was Mark Willis, if I remember correctly, and he became notorious instantly in the newsroom for the guy who was like known as the Cheerios man, because he came out of that cereal industry. And so he came in and with, you know, the anticipated cost cutting and kind of more corporate attitude. And in turn, then following up on that, Times Mirror was bought by Tribune, which, you know, the flagship was the Chicago Tribune. And it's very interesting, I don't write about it in this book, but I wrote a column where the reporting on that purchase, the New York Times had some very snide comments about Tribune being just this bottom line company, whereas the story in the LA Times was very complimentary about what a really fine management company this was and how they really were concerned with not just the bottom line but the quality of the journalistic product. Well, you have the
check. We're back. Looks like we're back.
So anyway, where should we go with this?
Oh, just keep talking. Oh, it's fine.
Well, I was remembering, and I think this is kind of relevant to the point you're raising. Lori Garrett, for many years, was a reporter for Newsday. Mm-hmm. She worked very hard as a science reporter and public policy reporter, and won the Pulitzer, won the Polk, just showered with honors for her reporting, books and so forth, really acclaimed. And as we speak, I think it was a number of months ago, she quit and slammed the door as she left. A scathing letter, which was posted on the Poynter Institute website, that she basically released to her colleagues.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, one might say that Lori Garrett, who had a number of real, real bestsellers, I'm not talking about like I had a bestseller because I was on the Chronicle list for a few weeks. I mean, major national bestsellers that probably, you know, put $1 million in her assets or something. Maybe she was more able to say, hey, I'm out of here, and not only that, I'm going to burn a bridge with the Tribune Company and Newsday. But be that as it may, her letter is scathing. Mm-hmm. If you Google Lori Garrett, it's fascinating. She's caustic. She condemns, even before Tribune bought the LA Times and swallowed up Times Mirror, she just said the management that was brought in was decimating quality journalism. And I think there's really a feeling like that among really quality, good journalists like Lori Garrett. I remember personally, this is anecdotal, but I think tracks with what has been happening. I co-wrote with Martin Lee the book Unreliable Sources, and when it came out in 1990, I was on some panels. One was with a publisher of the Sacramento Bee, which is, you know, believed to be one
McClatchy,
of the better.
McClatchy, I think?
Yeah, exactly. McClatchy, one of the better chains, one of the better papers. And I gave what I thought in 1990 was a pretty mild, certainly not overstated critique when my turn came to speak on the panel. I was influenced by, and I'm glad to have been, by Ben Bagdikian in his book, The Media Monopoly. And I raised questions about media ownership. I said that it was not positive in terms of the corporate consolidation, the effects on working journalists and the quality of journalism. And this man whose name, as I recall, is Peter Batya, when it was his turn to speak, he rather dramatically held up a written prepared text and tossed it aside and said, I had a prepared speech, but I'm going to set it aside here because what Mr. Solomon has said is so outrageous, so defamatory to the journalistic profession. And he just kind of went on you know, what he probably considered to be a reasoned discourse. I thought it might have been more like a rant, but you know, however one terms it, he was just totally offended and made that clear. I don't think that would be nearly as likely to happen anymore. I've interacted with many journalists who 15 years ago really saw it as a non-problem, thought Bagdikian was alarmist in talking about a media monopoly. There's very little question about that anymore. People, if they're laid off, if they're victims of speed up, if they see what's happening in the newsroom, they don't question that there's a basic connection between who owns and how it's run on the one hand and the quality of journalism on the other.
Well, we mentioned Lori Garrett. Can you name any other examples of what you consider good journalism?
Oh, good journalism. I think it's going on all the time. Seymour Hersh, Robert Perry, who did a lot of that for AP and then Newsweek in the late 1980s, although as he's told me and as I've written about, it became very difficult for him really to do his job as he thought it needed to be done, which is just to say, to report independently on what the first Bush administration, what turned out to be the first Bush administration, was doing. And there are, I would say, you could go to any state in the country and you would find good journalism being done.
I was wondering if you had any particular qualitative data that average Americans, meaning mainstream Americans who might watch Fox News, are concerned with the welfare of other nations. If a Fox News executive sort of said to you, you know, he'd say, you know, we're giving them exactly what they want. They don't care about Bosnia. They looked the other way. They looked the other way when the Rwandan genocide happened in 94. So how would you respond to this sort of idea that Fox News is fulfilling what they perceive to be the needs of the population base? Or are those needs actually true, do you think?
Well, yeah, you know, people can't choose from choices that aren't available to them. And the production values that are comparable to the networks, for instance, are very expensive. You know, you can't just pass the hat and start, for that matter, USA Today or Fox News or MSNBC or whatever. Very capital intensive. It requires an outlay before you can really do it and then hopefully, from the investor standpoint, turn a profit. So the option of entertaining, well-presented cable news networks, for instance, that have a different set of priorities, that really doesn't exist. Linda Ellerbee, the sometimes maverick newswoman, has said very clearly, and this is a very close paraphrase, she said, the argument that the public is just getting what it wants from the TV networks is just an excuse to put Drek on the air. It's a way to displace the decision away from where it really is being made, which is in the upper reaches of the executive suites. They've decided that's the way to make a big profit. As it happens, it certainly does not have a dissonant relationship to their corporate priorities. I mean, you know, a classic kind of illuminator of that is when Disney bought ABC from Cap Cities, and on the weekend there was a national call-in talk show hosted by Jim Hightower.
Yeah.
And the next Saturday comes around, he goes on the air, he says, guess what, folks, this network has been bought by a rodent, referring to Mickey Mouse. Well, you know, he didn't last long. He knew it was a disconnect between his politics and the ownership, would see that a lot of potential corporate sponsors would not want to sign on to a show hosted by someone who, as they saw it, bashed corporations. So there are, you know, it's not like these are neutral entities of just bean counters who say, hey, we're going to make, you know, make money this way, and we're not going to make money that way. In the grand scheme of things, they do need a kind of a sync there between content and their politics, but not always. You know, but I do think that there's a problem with just the very basic structure of how you design a profit-making enterprise, and you do the Bachelorette show, and nobody's going to sue you, probably. Certainly nobody with deep pockets, and it's not a problem. You can make a lot of profit. It won't cost you a lot to do it.
Well, there's also the cult of personality cut factor. I'm not sure if you saw, there was a issue of Esquire magazine roughly about 2 months ago. I'm not sure if you saw it, but
no.
It had Donald Rumsfeld on the cover as an ideal man of the year. And if you opened the actual, you opened it up, there were all these photos of Donald Rumsfeld in his office smiling, almost fatherly. It was extremely sort of disturbing to me, but I threw the magazine to the side. I was shocked that they did this. That it has that level where Donald Rumsfeld can now be on the cover of Esquire magazine as sort of some sort of a men's magazine, you know, as this is this is your role model. You know, what do you say to that? I mean, if it's gone that far, how can this be overturned?
Well, avuncular daddy who orders the bombs to fall. You know, Esquire published the as I remember, it might have been Harper's, but Miami and the Siege of Chicago essays by Norman Mailer. I mean, Esquire has a rather, shall we say, distinguished history and very cutting edge against the grain stuff.
Yeah, I know. That's what shocked me about this.
Yeah, very much. And I think, you know, but this is, to me, it is a characteristic of the big wash, the oceans of corporate money. They find the crevices and the big valleys and they sweep on in. And I think you're giving just a very good example. There's shockers. I've written about the Fortunate Son, Favorite Son song by Creedence Clearwater. After 9/11, I remember, it was on an ad, and they turned it off right before the verse that had the political anti-militarism punch. So it was absolutely inverted. It was like when Ronald Reagan used Springsteen's Born in the USA until Springsteen asked him to stop it. You know, and that can really be done.
Yeah.
It really can be done with enough money.
Well, we are being kicked out of this cafe, unfortunately.
Okay.
But thank you very much, Dorman, for talking.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Yeah. Really good questions, by the way, and I'm really appreciative of the chance to talk with you.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Coming up next time, how does a t-shirt convey a message? Does the message mean something, or does it need to be something entertaining? Find out as we talk with Periel Aschenbrand, who was a very interesting young lady, and our correspondent may or may not have been intimidated. Well, you'll have to go ahead and find out for yourself. Thank you very much, Mr. Sullivan, and thank you for listening to the Bat Segundo Show.